Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson, along with Sarah Williams.
China and the United States discuss security and economic issues during high-level talks in Beijing.
Chinese President Xi Jinping marks the 77th anniversary of the beginning of the war with Japan by denouncing those he says ignore historical facts.
A Chinese court sentences a Christian pastor to 12 years in prison.
Our roundtable segment looks at last week's pro-democracy rally in Hong Kong.
And author Lisa C. tells us about Asian American dancers during World War II, which is the subject of her new book, China Dolls. Hello and welcome to China Focus.
Let's look at some of the biggest news stories this week.
The second day of high-level talks between the United States and China concluded in Beijing Thursday, and the two sides appeared to make little headway on a range of security and economic issues. The talks occurred as China faces new allegations of cyber spying against the U.S. Quoting senior American officials late Wednesday, the New York Times reported that Chinese hackers broke into a network that contains U.S. government personnel files.
The officials, Sarah, say the incident took place in March, and they appeared to have attempted to access the personnel files of tens of thousands of federal employees who have applied for top-secret security clearances. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security are quoted in U.S. media reports as confirming an intrusion took place, but they have not found any loss of personally identifiable information. China has denied the allegations and has also accused Washington of cyber spying on Beijing.
Shannon Van Sant reports from the Chinese capital.
The annual U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue gives both countries an opportunity to talk about bilateral relations. At a news conference, Secretary of State John Kerry affirmed the U.S. commitment to good relations with China. Kerry said he only learned of an attempt by Chinese hackers to gain access to government personnel files after the conclusion of his meetings with Chinese leaders. He says no sensitive information appears to have been compromised in the hacking attacks, but said he had frank discussions with Chinese leaders on cybersecurity. Kerry said U.S. officials were able to find common ground with Beijing on several issues, including nuclear nonproliferation, the importance of the rule of law, the rise in tensions with China's neighbors, and in-depth discussions on military-to-military talks. But he provided few details. The highest-profile agreement to come out of the talks was a series of deals on climate change. The partnership pacts involved companies and research organizations and the sharing of clean coal and carbon capture technologies. On Thursday, China State Councilor Yang Jiechi said that building better ties requires mutual respect. He says building a new model of relationship between China and the United States requires us to respect each other, treat each other with sincerity, correctly view each other's strategic intentions, and avoid strategic misjudgment. Thursday's talks began with a breakfast that included entrepreneurs from the United States and China. At a time when there are continuing tensions between the two nations, many see economic cooperation as a key opportunity. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew addressed the gathering.
Today, strengthening the commercial relationships remains an important task ahead of us. It's a way to create economic growth and jobs in our two countries, and it's a way to help drive the global economy forward.
Following Thursday's meetings, Liu said China is committed to reducing market intervention and revaluation of its currency. He said steps were also taken towards the signing of a bilateral investment treaty. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. There are many ways that we reach out to you, and there's a new way that you can reach out to us. We'll have more on that later in the program.
On Monday, Chinese President Xi Jinping marked the 77th anniversary of the beginning of 8 years of war with Japan. He criticized what he called a minority group of people who ignore historical facts, who ignore the tens of thousands of lives lost in the war, and deny and even beautify the history of aggression.
Mr. Xi, speaking at the site where the so-called Marco Polo Bridge incident on July 7, 1937 occurred, and that served as a pretext triggering the Sino-Japanese War. He said the Chinese people will steadfastly guard history, which is written with our lives and blood, and resolutely oppose anyone who wants to deny, twist, or even embellish the invasion of history.
Speaking last week at Seoul National University, Mr. Xi denounced what he called the barbarous wars of aggression against China and Korea by Japanese militarists. Tufts University Korea expert Soon-Young Lee in Seoul told VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Xi has an incentive to try to drive a wedge between South Korea and Japan.
It makes sense for Xi to play upon the common factor with South Korea of historical victimization at the hands of Imperial Japan in the 20th century. And I thought his invocation of this true, huge international war in the 1590s, in the wake of Japan's invasion of Korea, with a view toward marching into China, in which Ming China entered its satellite, Joseon Korea, to repel the Japanese invaders. That was a masterful bit of propaganda.
He continued somewhat that theme as China marked the 77th anniversary of the start of the war with Japan at the so-called 1937 Marco Polo Bridge incident.
And for China, it does make sense to occasionally bring this up because it was a traumatic and humiliating experience. And certainly China and the Chinese population at large were victimized by Imperial Japan going back to the 1930s. And we know that Japan, since 1945, has been a paragon of peace and prosperity, development. Yet this first-rate nation, industrialized, one of the most advanced countries in the world, modern Japan, its leadership went back on its previous apologies. Japan has not been as forthcoming about its imperial pre-1945 actions, aggression, atrocities as Germany and other wartime aggressors. So from a domestic standpoint, it does make sense for Xi to play upon these common factors of victimization and intense nationalism. However, his analogy of this war that took place more than 400 years ago is obviously misplaced. It's as misplaced as his intention is transparent because the analogy just doesn't hold up. Japan today is neither the expansionist pre-1945 empire nor the pre-unified kingdom overrun by warlords more than 400 years ago.
Japan's chief cabinet secretary said efforts by South Korea and China to make history an issue and take it to the global stage will not help build peace and cooperation in the region.
Last week, Japan eased restrictions on its military in an historic move away from the country's pacifist post-World War II policies. The change is intended to allow Japan to defend friendly nations that come under attack.
Also last week, a Chinese court sentenced a Christian pastor to 12 years in prison in a verdict his supporters call totally unacceptable.
Zhang Shaoyi was arrested last year following a land dispute with local authorities. His lawyer told the Associated Press authorities arrested the pastor because he was becoming too influential in the community.
The official charges were fraud and gathering crowds to disrupt public order. Bob Fu, who heads the U.S.-based Christian rights group China Aid, said the verdict is religious persecution.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki on Monday had this reaction to the verdict.
I want to express deep concern by the United States by reports that Zhang Shengzhe, pastor of the government-sanctioned Nanlu County Christian Church, was convicted July 4th and sentenced to 12 years imprisonment in retaliation for his peaceful advocacy on behalf of his church community. We call on Chinese authorities to release Pastor Zhang, and we urge China to cease harassment of his family, members, and congregants. We call on the Chinese authorities to allow citizens to worship freely in accordance with China's own laws and its international human rights commitments. Freedom of religion is critical to a peaceful, inclusive, stable, and thriving society.
There are 23 million Christians in China, according to official estimates. This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we talk with author Lisa See about her new book, China Dolls. In Hong Kong last week, hundreds of thousands of people participated in a pro-democracy rally that was followed by a sit-in by student groups. Five of the protest leaders have been charged by police.
The protest followed an unofficial referendum on democracy. More than 10% of Hong Kong's population voted for residents to be able to nominate candidates for the territory's leader.
We asked three experts on China and Hong Kong to comment on the referendum and the rally. Jerome Cohen is a professor at the New York University School of Law and the adjunct senior fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Michael Martin is an Asian Affairs Specialist at the Congressional Research Service. And Andrew Leung is an international and independent China specialist based in Hong Kong.
We asked our guests, beginning with Mr. Leung, whether they thought Beijing had been startled by the size of the protest.
Well, first of all, there is rising social discontent in Hong Kong, now characterized by inequalities, characterized by very high property prices, beyond the reach of a lot of young people. So there's a great deal of social discontent building up. Now, secondly, well, Hong Kong has returned to the motherland for 17 years. But amongst the younger generation, some of the hearts and minds haven't returned. I mean, there is a Hong Kong identity, which just regard themselves as most of the youngsters nowadays regard themselves as Hong Kong. And there was a recent survey on their identity, and people say, well, we're not Chinese, we're Hong Kong. I mean, I'm of course, referring to the younger people. And then thirdly, the politics is getting more and more fractious because some of the political parties, they're trying to block and filibuster government agendas, government proposals, so as to gain a political advantage. So all these forces are being hijacked into sort of movement for more democracy. Now, on democracy, and people have been making it up or have been trying to create the impression that the central government, that Beijing, has somehow reneged on its promise for universal suffrage. Well, this is far from the case, because Beijing has never said that it's giving up his promise. It's a very, very solemn official promise of universal suffrage by 2017.
Mr. Martin,
let me get back this is Michael Martin, getting back to your original question, which is the size of the turnout. And there are varying estimates on how many people actually participated in the demonstration. The Hong Kong police force estimated roughly over 90,000. The organizers themselves put the figure at over 500,000. An independent group, the Hong Kong University Public Opinion Program, did a more scientific looking at the number of people passing by a station. And they came up with a figure somewhere between 150 and 200,000, depending on various calculations that they make. And your question was in terms of surprise. I don't know if I could comment about their surprise, but certainly I think it's a matter of concern for them, because the last time you saw a demonstration, particularly on July 1st, the anniversary of the handover of this size, was the year before Tung Chee Hwa stepped down, at a time when proposals for an anti-sedition act were being put forward and were very unpopular. So to sort of segue into what Mr. Leung was talking about, you do have a lot of popular discontent in Hong Kong, some concerns in the population about their future. And the fact that roughly one in, say, 30 or 40, 35 or 40 people in Hong Kong chose to demonstrate publicly that they want compliance with what is seen by many as a promise or a potential promise by the Chinese government for selection of the chief executive by universal suffrage in 2017, I think is something of concern for the Chinese government as well as the Hong Kong government.
Beijing issued a so-called white paper on Hong Kong that asserted its ultimate authority over the territory. And also the rally occurred shortly after the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. The confluence of these two events, how did those affect this rally and mood in Hong Kong? Did that help to maybe inflate the feelings at this time? Professor Cohen?
Well, it's clear that the Hong Kong people have been disturbed ever since June 4th, anniversary gave this whole occasion much greater salience than it might otherwise have. And people in Hong Kong are pretty sophisticated, and they know that the mainland in the last year and a half or so has become even more repressive domestically. And that has an impact on their own concerns and how they perceive the attempt by the Chinese government to manipulate the vague words of the declaration jointly signed by the United Kingdom and China in 1984 and the basic law that China enacted for Hong Kong in 1990. Words are not self-defining. They have to be applied. And words like democracy, universal suffrage, do not have apparent meaning. And there's a struggle, as Andrew has indicated, over what meaning to attach to these terms. Beijing obviously wants to continue to control the political process so that people in Hong Kong cannot freely express their will. They have to be limited to candidates put forth by the group Beijing selects as the nominating group. You can allow everybody to vote in Hong Kong as long as you control whom they can vote for. What people are asking for among the articulate activists, you might say, who are a minority of the people in Hong Kong, is the right to name their own candidates. And what Beijing will insist on, obviously, is that the only candidates who can be voted on are those acceptable to Beijing. So this is creating inevitable tension, and this demonstrates the limits of one country, two systems. Business community, I'm afraid Hong Kong is destined now for a difficult period, and this has to be understood in the broader context of what's going on in China, both externally and internally. I've already said internally in China, there's a huge amount of tension. There's a high degree of leadership struggle. There's a great attempt to punish corruption, but that has limits because it would, if really punished freely, corruption would go to the very highest levels. You have other huge domestic problems, and Xi Jinping, unfortunately, is relying on a high degree of coercion to keep the lid on domestically. At the same time, China, in recent years, and it's getting worse, is creating a lot of tension on its periphery. South China Sea, the East China Sea, has cost China dearly in its foreign policy.
The organizers of the recent protest have been charged with minor offenses. Andrew Leung, you're on the ground. Do you feel that that will be discouraging people from defying Beijing? Is it possible that Beijing could even send in the military to handle large protests?
Well, I don't. Well, unless things are getting really out of hand. And if you look at the kind of so-called movement or demonstrations, and I was unfortunately that evening, you know, caught in a crowd because I was trying to make my way to an interview studio. So I got myself caught up with that. So I saw it with my own eyes, you know, how this was going on. Almost 90%, 95% of the people were the so-called post-80s, you know, people born after the 1980, people under 35. And most of them are hot-headed young students. But then if you look at the, Hong Kong, well, Hong Kong for the 20th year has won the allocate of being the freest economy according to the Heritage Foundation. 20 years with non-stop. Now, of course, it's not just the economy. I mean, adopting the standards of a Heritage Foundation, if there is a repression, there's bound to affect the freedom in the economy, and Hong Kong would not have been able to retain its position as the freest economy status according to those standards for 20 years in a row.
Mr. Martin, with all this going on, you know, recently in what we saw in Hong Kong, Macau is going to have its own informal referendum on democracy
right
next month. What could the implications there be?
The situation in Macau is very similar to what you have in Hong Kong, although the economy is quite different. Where, as Mr. Leung pointed out, you have a large number of young people who are concerned about their future and what's going what their prospects are both politically and economically. So I think it's interesting that in Macau you have a similar call for a popular referendum on proposals.
Michael Martin, an Asian affairs specialist at the Congressional Research Service, Andrew Lung, an international and independent China specialist based in Hong Kong, and Jerome Cohen, a professor at the New York University School of Law and adjunct senior fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China. All to myself.
Chinese-American writer Lisa Si has published her latest novel, China Dolls. The book portrays the lives of three young Asian women in California just before and during the United States' involvement in World War II. All three women work in nightclubs on the so-called chop suey circuit, performing dance routines for audiences which include non-Asians. And all three women have secrets that are eventually revealed. She stopped in Washington recently on her book tour, and I spoke with her.
I just wanted to ask you, first of all, will the book be coming out in China? Do you know yet?
I don't know yet if the book is going to be coming out in China. My other books have been published there, but it's still pretty early, so, you know, you don't always know ahead of time. Mm-hmm.
What would you like Chinese readers of yours to know about this particular book?
I just think that when you look back at that time period, the 30s and 40s, you don't necessarily think of performers, and if you do, you tend to have a negative perception of them. I mean, even looking at how people considered Anna Mae Wong as somebody who had created stereotypes, but these were people who were really breaking the mold and really doing something that they absolutely loved and were very talented at, and so I feel like it's time that they should be recognized and embraced and celebrated.
Now, I believe your website has some videos and some of the songs people can listen to or look at.
Right. On my website, if you go to the China Dolls page, there's a place that says Step Into the World of China Dolls, and I have clips of the performers from movies and shorts, and also more recent interviews that they have given, as well as links to all of the music that's in the book, as well as different historical pieces, like even, you know, how chop suey was invented, and about the Golden Gate International Exhibition, and all kinds of things that people can discover that are related to the book.
Any possibility this might be made into a film?
Wouldn't that be fun? We'll have to wait and see, though.
Writer Lisa Si speaking about her new book, China Dolls.
As always on China Focus, we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. The times are changing. Some of our frequencies have changed, and you might not be able to hear our program at the same times and frequencies that you have previously. But we are on several frequencies. You can check them all out on our program page, voanews.com/China Focus. We're also on social media, Facebook and Twitter. Sarah's handle is at VOA Williams. I'm at VOA Stevenson.
And this week we have a new feature to tell you about. Here's Zoe to tell you how to follow and contact us on Sina Weibo.
Hey guys, I'm Zoe. We are running a Weibo account for VOA English. It is a great new channel to learn English. We will provide you many English learning resources like audio, video, and a script of the latest news. The name of our Weibo is VOA 英语官博，就是官方的官，微博的博。One more time, VOA 英语官博. You're welcome to follow VOA 英语官博 on Weibo. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Zoe, and we look forward to having you with us again on future programs. And we're excited to be able now to reach out to you through Weibo.
That's it for our show. I'm Sarah Williams.
And I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to China Focus.